This is an extremely true story that actually did happen. The names used in this story are completely fictional and made up. Any similarities to actual galactic events or real people is purely, purely coincidental. Chapter 1. The premise nobody asked for. The Intergalactic Union, which governs approximately 4.7 billion star systems and cannot agree on a standardized calendar, maintains a list of professions it considers precious. This list includes poets, philosophers, and rather predictably, astronomers. The reason for this classification was recorded in Union Document 7832-441-B, which states, "Astronomers are to be protected at all costs, for they are the only beings in the known universe who will stare directly into the infinite void of existence, notice that it is staring back, and instead of screaming, will say, 'I should measure that.' This makes them beyond invaluable. It also made them somewhat concerning. The planet Celdraxis, located in a region of space that humans would rather later describe as probably over there somewhere, had produced more astronomers per capita than any other world in the Union. This was largely because Celdraxis had 17 moons, 4 of which were visible during the day. And children there grew up asking questions like, 'Why is that one wobbling?' before they could properly walk. One such child was named Vesto Slifer. From an early age, he kept intricate notes on the moons and all their unusual doings. This made him the perfect candidate for what the Union called quiet field study, which was bureaucratic terminology for go somewhere boring and don't cause an incident, underlined twice. The planet selected was Earth. Earth had been on the Union's watch list for several centuries, primarily because its dominant species had developed the ability to look at stars while somehow maintaining the belief that they were the only ones doing so. This combination of curiosity and obliviousness made them fascinating subjects for study. Also, and this is pretty important, they had excellent coffee, though they didn't know why." Chapter 2. The worst alias in the universe. The Office of Interstellar Integration, which handled all matters of extraterrestrial cover identities, operated out of a building that existed in 17 dimensions simultaneously. This made it very difficult to find the bathroom, as you can imagine, but excellent for keeping secrets. Agent Threnix 9, a being who resembled what would happen if a filing cabinet achieved enlightenment, was assigned to process Vesto Slifer's Earth documentation. "Your cover family will be the Ups," Threnix 9 proudly announced, while sliding a folder across a desk that may or may not have been there. "Former off-world operatives, good people, quiet, will welcome you with open arms. App is part of your mother's name." "And my name?" Vesto asked with the tone of someone who already knew they weren't going to like the answer. "Melville, App. There was just silence. It was the specific kind of silence that occurs when the universe has just made a joke and is waiting for everyone to get it. "I'm sorry," Vesto said carefully. "I may have misheard you. I thought you said Melvin." "Melvin App. It tested well with focus groups." "What focus groups? Human ones? They found it pleasantly forgettable?" Vesto stared at the agent. The agent stared back. The desk may or may not have stared at both of them, too. "I am not," Vesto said, with the careful precision of someone trying very hard not to scream, "going to introduce myself as Melvin App. It sounds like something you'd name a disappointed sandwich. It sounds human. It sounds like what happens when consonants give up." He took the folder away. He had no choice. But from that moment forward, he devoted approximately 340% more mental energy to resenting his alias than to actually learning human customs. This would prove to be a significant tactical error. Chapter 3. Arrival on Earth. Things go sideways early. Arizona, the early 20th century, was a place where the sky was so clear that you could see forever. And the ground? It was so dry that it would actively try to kill you if you weren't paying attention. It was, in other words, perfect for astronomers. The Lowell Observatory sat atop a hill that the locals called Mars Hill, though Mars was actually about 140 million miles to the upper left and had no opinion on the matter. Vesto arrived in the traditional manner, aboard a vessel disguised as an unusually ambitious dust devil, carrying nothing but his instruments, his credentials, and a profound reluctance to use the name Melvin under any circumstance. His integration was supposed to be seamless. He was supposed to blend in, make quiet observations, and file reports that no one would read for several centuries. Instead, he met Percival Lowell. Oh boy. Percival Lowell was the kind of human who made the universe nervous. He had money, which was dangerous. He had curiosity, which was way worse. And he had an observatory, which meant he had the means to act on both. He was also, by all accounts, tremendously pleasant, which made everything more complicated. "New fellow, are you?" Lowell asked, materializing beside Vesto with the silent efficiency of a man who owned the building and knew exactly where all the interesting people were at all times. Vesto looked up from the spectrograph he was calibrating. He had been on Earth for approximately 6 hours. He was tired. He was still annoyed about this whole Melvin thing, and he was not prepared for human social interaction. "Yes," he said. And here. Oh my gosh. The universe held its breath. Chapter 4. The Catastrophic Introduction. What Vesto should have said was, "Melvin App, pleased to meet you." What Vesto actually said, "Oh my gosh," was Vesto Slipher. The words left his mouth with the casual confidence of someone who had been using that name for his entire life, which he had, because it was his actual name. There was a moment of approximately 0.7 seconds where Vesto's brain caught up with his mouth. It was not a pleasant moment. It was the kind of moment where you realize you've just told a complete stranger your real identity on a planet where you're supposed to be undercover, and there is absolutely nothing you can do about it, because the words are already out there, floating in the air like evidence at a crime scene. Lowell blinked.
Vesto Slifer? That's unusual.
Is it? Vesto heard himself say, which was his brain's way of buying time while it screamed internally.
Well, it's rather exotic. Where is it from?
Seldraxis, Vesto's brain supplied unhelpfully.
It's from Seldraxis, you absolute fool, and you've just blown your cover in the first hour because you couldn't be bothered to learn your alias properly.
Indiana, Vesto said instead, because Indiana was a place that existed, and he was reasonably certain humans came from there.
Ah, Lowell nodded,
apparently satisfied.
And your first name is
Vesto?
Yes, Vesto Melvin Slifer.
There was another pause. Vesto watched Lowell's face for signs of suspicion, alarm, or the imminent arrival of whatever passed for authorities on this planet. Instead, Lowell just looked mildly confused, which was apparently the default human response to unexpected information.
Melvin, like that whale fellow. Yes?
Wonderful. Good to have you aboard, Slifer. Lowell shook his hand vigorously.
Let me know if you need anything. Telescope time, equipment, sandwiches. We have excellent sandwiches.
And then he left. Vesto stood alone in the observatory, his hand still slightly warm from the handshake, his cover identity in absolute ruins, and his career potentially completely and utterly destroyed. But somehow, the conversation was over. Humans, he was beginning to realize, were very strange about names.
Interlude. A treaty on profanity, as recorded by the Union Office of Linguistic Oversight. 7,000 light years away, High Chancellor Elara Maris received the incident report. She read it 3 times. Then she invented new words. This was not unusual. Elara Maris was legendary throughout the Union for her creative approach to profanity. Where other beings would simply curse, she would compose. Her expletives were not merely exclamations, they were experiences.
The 5 curse phrases she created in response to the Slifer incident, oh my gosh, would later be taught in advanced linguistics courses across 12 star systems. They were Nyx Ara Astralis, literal translation, to grab a Moon Moon Cow from beneath. Context. Moon Moon Cows are creatures that exist in the gravitational sweet spot between binary moons. They are, by all accounts, docile, peaceful, and absolutely furious.
if you touch them from below. This is because their undersides are where they keep their feelings. To call someone an Ixara Astralis is to suggest they have done something so monumentally catastrophically stupid that it's equivalent to reaching up the peaceful darkness of space and grabbing a 2-ton emotional cow by its most vulnerable bits. The phrase is usually accompanied by a gesture that cannot be described in print, but involves both hands and a look of profound disappointment.
Ugh. Ardan Hellyor! Literal translation? To pull the legs of a newborn galaxy straight from its mother's black hole. Context. This one requires some astronomical explanation. When galaxies are born, and they are born, messily and magnificently, they emerge from regions of such intense gravitational chaos that even light has second thoughts. The process is sacred, violent, and absolutely not to be interfered with. To Ardan Hellyor is to suggest that someone has not merely made a mistake, but has done it so in a way that violates the fundamental dignity of creation itself. It implies a level of cosmic rudeness that transcends mere offense and enters the realm of ontological vandalism. High Chancellor Maris used this phrase 6 times. While reading paragraph 3 of the incident report. Miret Eclipterum. Literal translation. The punching of a private part that only lunar lice have. Context. Lunar lice are parasites that exist on approximately 340 moons throughout the galaxy. They are tiny. They are really annoying, and they have a single, highly specific, anatomical feature that exists for no discernible purpose except, apparently, to be referenced in profanity. It's true. It's true. What makes Miret Eclipterum particularly devastating as an insult is the implication that you would first have to find the relevant body part, which is microscopic, hidden, and, according to xenobiologists, genuinely unpleasant to contemplate. Ugh. To call someone this is to suggest that they have not only done something wrong, but that correcting them would require a level of precision, patience, and willingness to engage with the deeply unpleasant that nobody should be expected to provide. Halvek Drake. Literal translation, kissing the lips of a reverse space bird. Context. The reverse space birds are creatures that fly backwards through time. This means that by the time you see one, it has already left. Their lips, if they can be called that, exist in a state of perpetual yesterday. To Halvek Draith someone is to accuse them of pursuing something that is not only impossible, but retroactively impossible. A goal so futile that even if you achieved it, it would have already unhappened. It's the Union's equivalent of calling someone a fool who chases rainbows. Except, the rainbow is traveling backwards through causality, and the chase itself is erasing your footsteps as you run. High Chancellor Maris used this one at full volume. Aurelion. Literal translation, redacted by the Intergalactic Censorship Board, Order 77, Gamma
9.
Yeah.
Context.
The Intergalactic Censorship Board has determined that the act described by Aurelian cannot be explained in any language, living or dead, without causing permanent psychological discomfort to all beings capable of imagination. In a word, ew. What can be said is this. It involves star cloacas.
Oh my gosh. This is the narrator telling you, do not look up cloaca. Don't. Just don't.
We can additionally add that it is apparently physically possible. Though inadvisable, especially if you're a superstar. 3 Union linguists who attempted to translate it for the official record have since requested memory modification.
Yeah.
The phrase is banned on 47 planets. That's no joke. Not because it is offensive, but because the mental image it creates is way too spicy. High Chancellor Maris said this one quietly.
But you know what? It made things a lot worse.
Chapter 5. The Almost Disclosure Incident. The problem with Vesto Slifer, from the Union's perspective, was that he was very, very, very good at his job. This should have been a positive thing. It was not. Because Vesto, in his quest to study Earth astronomers, kept accidentally revolutionizing their science. It started small. A comment here about spectral analysis, an observation there about galactic motion. Little things that any competent astronomer might notice. If that astronomer happened to have access to technology several centuries ahead of Earth's development.
That's an interesting approach to redshift, a colleague mentioned one afternoon.
Is it?
Vesto said, as he always does, looking up from calculations that had taken Earth scientists, well, the better part of 3 years to replicate.
It's just, you seem very confident about galaxies moving away from us.
Well, they are, Vesto said.
But the mathematics?
The mathematics are quite straightforward once you stop assuming you're at the center of everything.
There was a pause.
That's a very philosophical way to put it, the man said.
Is it?
Vesto said again, returning to his work.
This kind of exchange happened approximately once a week.
Union observers, monitoring from a comfortable distance of several astronomical units, began filing reports with increasingly alarmed language.
Subject demonstrates repeatedly knowledge inconsistent with Earth's technological development. Subject has casually mentioned the existence of other island universes, as though this were common knowledge. It is not common knowledge. Please advise. Subject appears to be accidentally solving problems that Earth's astronomers have been working on for decades. This is causing professional jealousy and suspicious questions. Recommend intervention. Urgent. Subject used the phrase, back on my home, and then corrected himself. Back in Indiana? Indiana does not have the atmospheric conditions he was describing. This is because Indiana does not have 3 suns. Please advise immediately.
The Union response was swift and bureaucratic. Vesto was filed under a new classification that has been created specifically for this situation.
Brilliant, but a liability. The classification came with special monitoring protocols, quarterly reviews, and a very sternly worded letter reminding him that cover identities existed for a reason, and perhaps he should try using his. Vesto read the letter, then he went back to measuring redshifts, because the universe was expanding and somebody ought to document it properly. Union protocols, be damned. Chapter 6. Lowell figures it out. Percival Lowell was many things. Wealthy, eccentric, passionate, and possessed an enthusiasm that could generously be described as uncontainable, and less generously as honestly a bit much. But above all else, Percival Lowell was observant. Yep. This was an occupational hazard of being an astronomer. You spent so much time looking carefully at things that were very far away that you couldn't help but to notice things that were very close. Things like colleagues who used terminology that hadn't been invented yet. Things like equations that solved problems nobody had formally posed. Things like a man who introduced himself with a name that sounded less like Indiana and more like somewhere where mathematics works differently. Slifer, Lower said one evening, settling into a chair next to the telescope with the casual determination of a man who had decided to have a conversation, whether the other party wanted it or not. I have a theory. Vesto, who had been peacefully cataloging stellar spectra, felt a cold sensation that humans would recognize as, well, dread. Do you? I do. Lowell steepled his fingers. I have been watching you for some time now.
That's terrible of you.
You know things, Slifer. Things you shouldn't know. Things that don't make sense unless... He paused, letting the moment stretch. Unless you're not from around here. There was a silence. The telescope ticked quietly, tracking some distant star. Outside, the Arizona night was vast and dark and full of secrets. I'm from Indiana, Vesto said carefully.
No, you're not.
I assure you, Slifer. Lowell leaned forward. I've dedicated my life to looking at Mars. I've spent decades convinced there is intelligent life out there. I've built an observatory on a hill and spent my fortune staring at the sky. He smiled. A genuine smile, a beautiful smile, without fear or accusation. Did you really think I'd be upset to find out I was right? Vesto opened his mouth, closed it, and opened it again. You're not alarmed? Alarmed? Lowell laughed, actually laughed. The sound echoing off the whole dome. My dear fellow, I am delighted. I've spent my entire career being told I was seeing things that weren't there. Channels on Mars, signs of civilization, evidence of life beyond Earth. He gestured broadly at Vesto. And here you are. Proof.
This is highly irregular. Oh, undoubtedly. I imagine there are protocols, forms to fill out, stern conversations with superiors. Lowell waved a hand dismissively. He was just an amazing person. I don't care about any of that. What do you care about?
The question hung in the air. Lowell's eyes, bright, curious, utterly fearless, met Vesto's. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Percival Lowell. Listen to this.
I want to see where you're from.
This was, Vesto would later reflect, the most astronomer response possible. Chapter 7. Earth loses a representative. The year was 1916. Percival Lowell was 61 years old, or young, rather. It is a fine age for starting new adventures if you happen to be the sort of a person who believes that age is more of a suggestion than limitation. He was also, according to Earth records, deceased.
This was technically accurate. The body that Earth buried was, in fact, a body. The Union had excellent fabrication technology, basically 3D printing, and fast as heck. Creating a convincing human was considered a level 2 operation, complex enough to require paperwork, but simple enough to be completed by Tuesday. It's a handheld device.
What Earth did not know was that the original Percival Lowell had, 3 days prior to his official death, boarded a vessel, oh yes, bound for Celdraxus, and with the enthusiasm of a man who had waited his entire life for exactly this invitation. Ladies and gentlemen, the universe is just. Things happen even though you may not know they happen. Oh yes, it's almost mathematical, but it's all about heart. No good deed goes unnoticed, believe you me. He brought very little. Some notebooks, his favorite pen, a photograph of his observatory. He left behind a legacy. A scientific institution, fully operational to this day, and amazing too. And approximately zero indication that anything unusual had occurred. That is always important. You don't mess with that.
You're certain about this? Vesto had asked during the quiet hours before departure.
Absolutely! Lowell was practically vibrating with excitement like a little kitten. I spent my whole life looking up. Now I get to look back.
It's a long journey.
Excellent! I've brought books.
You won't be able to return.
My dear Slifer.
Lowell paused, smiled, and said, May I call you Vesto?
You may.
Vesto, then. I have spent 61 years on a planet that thinks I'm eccentric for believing in life beyond Earth. I have argued with colleagues, endured skepticism, and built an observatory on a hill in Arizona just so I could get a slightly better look at Mars.
He straightened his jacket with the air of a man preparing for the journey of several lifetimes.
I am very much looking forward to be proven right. The departure was quiet, as such things usually are.
Earth continued its orbit around the sun, unaware it had just gained its first and thus far only official representative to the Intergalactic Union.
and no one noticed. This was probably for the best. Chapter 8. The Long Way Home.
Space, it turns out, is extremely big. This is the kind of observation that sounds obvious until you're actually traveling through it, at which point it becomes the only thing you can think about. Vesto Slifer's return journey to Seldraxis took, by Earth reckoning, several decades. By Union's reckoning, it took approximately one standard travel unit, which is a measurement of time that doesn't actually mean anything, but makes the paperwork a lot easier. He did not travel alone. Emma had found him in Arizona, which was either a coincidence or the universe's way of apologizing for the whole Melvin situation. She was brilliant, patient, and possessed of the particular kind of tolerance required to love someone who would rather measure the velocities of distant galaxies than engage in small talk.
"You're still thinking about the name thing," she observed approximately halfway between Earth and home. "I'm not. You've muttered Melvin in your sleep 3 times this week."
"I'm sorry, it's a terrible name."
"It was supposed to be forgettable. It was too forgettable. It forgot to be a real name and became a sound instead."
"Melvin."
Emma patted his hand sympathetically. She had heard this argument before. She would hear it again. This was marriage. Chapter 9. Two men. One planet. Too many stories. Seldraxis, as previously mentioned, had 17 moons. It also had excellent wine, a climate that Earth poets would describe as perpetually golden hour, and a small cottage on the edge of a lavender-colored sea where 2 old astronomers met for dinner every 3rd rotation. Percival Lowell, formerly of Earth, currently of everywhere, had adapted magnificently to extraterrestrial life. This was because Percival Lowell had the kind of personality that adapted magnificently to everything. Give him a new planet and he would spend the first week cataloging its moons. Give him a new species and he would learn to make them laugh. Give him 400 years of extended lifespan. It was indefinite by that time, a standard union benefit for the registered representatives, and he would use every single one of his days to ask questions. Ladies and gentlemen, that is Percival Lowell.
"I still don't understand," he said, pouring wine that shimmered with colors Earth grapes had never imagined. "How they didn't notice you."
Vesto, comfortable, finally home, shrugged. "Humans don't notice things they're not looking for."
"I noticed."
"You were looking." Lowell considered this. He had spent a lifetime looking at Mars, at the sky, at the spaces between stars where life might be. He had been called obsessive, eccentric, and occasionally that canal fellow by people who thought they were being clever. He had also been right. "Earth is strange," he said finally.
"Agreed."
"The people are fascinating."
"Also agreed."
"The women," Lowell raised his glass, "are to die for." Emma, who had heard this toast before, and who was technically also from Earth, rolled her eyes affectionately. "And the astronomers?" Vesto asked. Lowell laughed.
It was the laugh of a man who had spent several centuries among the stars and still found joy in the question. The astronomers are the best part. We look at infinity and try to measure it. We stare into the void and take notes. He shook his head wonderingly. Honestly, it's a miracle any of us are allowed to function in society. Speaking of functioning in society, Vesta leaned back. They never did change the alias policy.
Still Melvin?
Yeah, still Melvin. That's criminal! I've said as much, formally several times, and they said it tested well with focus groups. Lowell laughed again. This time, Vesto joined him, and the sound carried out over the Lavender Sea, up past the 17 moons, and into the vast darkness of a universe that was, as Vesto had proven long ago, still expanding. Somewhere out there, galaxies were moving away from each other at tremendous speeds. Superluminal speeds, oh yes. Somewhere closer, two astronomers were moving toward dessert. And somewhere in the archives of the Intergalactic Union, there was a file labeled Slifer Vesto. See also Melvin App. With a note attached that read,
Case closed. Subject returned home. Recommend continued observation of Earth. Further recommend aliases should probably be optional.
The universe, as always, continued not to care. But for one evening, on one planet, under 17 moons that had no idea how important they were to the children who grew up asking questions about them, two old friends sat together and laughed and agreed. Earth was pretty strange. Humans were fascinating. And aliases, without question, absolutely the worst. The end. I hope I did not upset anyone by using these names. I really apologize. But Vesto Slifer and Percival Lowell are so important to planet Earth that we have to write about them and think about them and create poetry and movies and children's books. We need this. It's really important for our future.